Thank you for choosing this ABC Radio National podcast. When it's finished, we'll have details on other enlightening and entertaining programs that you may be interested in. But right now, here's your podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. We didn't do love when I was a philosophy student, or at least we didn't do it in our academic lives. Since then, however, even the formalistic, analytical tradition in which I was brought up has turned its attention to this most fundamental and basic of feelings, though not always with success. Jeanette Kennett is Principal Research Fellow at the Centre for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics at the Australian National University. She writes on a wide variety of topics, including love and friendship. And she begins this talk at the Melbourne Writers' Festival with a look at how we would have tackled the subject when I was a student, if we turned our attention to how you justify your love.
I'm afraid that some philosophers have not done well by the subject, to wit, my favourite example, which I discovered a few months ago from a philosopher who shall remain unnamed, and I quote, "If X loves Y, then X wants to benefit and be with Y, and he has these wants, or at least some of them, because he believes that Y has some determinate characteristics, V, in virtue of which he thinks it worthwhile to benefit and be with Y. And he regards satisfaction of these wants as an end and not as a means to some other end." Well, be still my beating heart. One can only imagine Y's deep delight at a lover's declaration couched in such terms. Surely the philosophical equivalent of Mr. Collins' proposal to Elizabeth Bennet in Pride and Prejudice. It's enough to send one rushing back to Barbara Cartland for advice on love. Who wouldn't prefer her silent, square-jawed, passionate heroes to this dry, cautious and distinctly unromantic approach? Such views, rather more attractively expressed, are common in philosophy, however. The idea is that love has reasons, as well as providing reasons, that we can explain and justify our loves by pointing to the qualities of the other which elicit love and which it is claimed warrant love. Love then involves in part a positive evaluation of those qualities. Now this is not so surprising as it might seem at first blush. After all, we're not usually stuck for an answer when asked what we love about our partners, friends or children. And the answers we give usually involve pointing to their superior virtues or cute or appealing properties. The tilt of her head, her warmth, her adventurous spirit, his subversive sense of humour and brilliant intellect. Such answers serve not merely to explain, but in some sense to justify our loves. They suggest that the beloved deserves to be loved on the basis of those very properties or characteristics. But views like these are subject to an obvious objection. Shakespeare said it, well, maybe first, I don't know. "Love is not love which alters, when it alteration finds or bends with the remover to remove. Oh no, it is an ever fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown, though his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved." In philosophy too, we find a view akin to this, known somewhat prosaically as the trading up objection. If the qualities view of love is correct, then it would seem that if I love you for your yellow hair, then when your hair ceases to be yellow, my love too may justifiably cease. If I love Tim for his loopy sense of humour and his musical talent, then surely under pain of inconsistency I cannot withhold my love from Tom, who has an even loopier sense of humour and a finer musical talent than Tim. Now, you may have met people who actually engage in trading up. Certainly you will have encountered them in popular culture. Think of the tycoon or movie star who regularly updates his wife. But I suspect that you along with Shakespeare would doubt that they truly love the objects of their passing attention. It's part of our very concept of love that it is non-fungible. It's not a commodity to be traded. The beloved is simply irreplaceable. That's why past or lost loves may be regretted and remembered in ways that past televisions are not. It seems we always fall short of the mark when we try to explain or justify love in terms of a list of qualities that the beloved contingently possesses. Worse still, those who go looking for love, armed with a checklist of essential qualities of the kind to be found in personal advertisements, 35 to 40 years old, C of E, non-smoking, professional, sporty, good sense of humour, likes cats, art house movies and Szechuan cuisine, seem unlikely to find it. And the reason is that love is essentially open-ended. In loving someone, we embark on a journey whose path and destination is largely unknown. Love takes us hostage to fortune. It binds us to the weal and woe of the beloved in ways we could not have anticipated and cannot reject. To be genuinely open to being someone's close friend or lover is precisely to admit to yourself that you're not entirely sure where the journey will take you. And this truism about love is one that the qualities view has a hard time accounting for. The point becomes even clearer when we shift focus from romantic love to love of one's children. While we can exhaustively enumerate their lovable qualities, we don't seriously suppose that our love for our children depends upon their continued possession of those very qualities. If that were the case, parental love would never survive the onset of adolescence and the loss of childish charms. Now, of course, defenders of the view will argue that their view of love is not nearly so crude nor so rigid as the trading up objection supposes. We needn't think that a person must be able to articulate all the qualities of the beloved which serve as reasons for love, just that those qualities do indeed justify the love that one has for them. Moreover, it's quite unlikely that the very particular constellation of qualities possessed by the beloved will be instantiated in just that way by another individual. Nevertheless, qualities matter for love, and some qualities may matter more than others. A Melbourne colleague of mine, Simon Keller, suggests that there are some properties which play a central, but not exclusive role in romantic love. These are the properties that make us good romantic partners. Properties like being a good listener, being caring and sensitive, being generous. Some of these properties will be relational properties. For example, one reason why someone might find you attractive as a romantic partner is that you know exactly how to treat him when he's in a bad mood. Just which properties make us good romantic partners is going to depend upon what we and our partners are like, so there's no list of the properties for which every romantic partner should be loved. When we speak of romantic love for properties, we mean especially, but not only, the properties that make someone a good romantic partner in the context of that particular relationship. Once we allow relational properties like this into the picture, trading up doesn't make much sense. A new person may share or exceed certain of the qualities we love in our existing friends and partners, a winning smile or musical talent, but they cannot share their relational and historical properties. They cannot, for example, be the person with whom I saw Elvis Costello, or played Scrabble till dawn, or celebrated my graduation, or mourned my father's death. Keller also reminds us that romantic love, and perhaps other loves too, ideally involve a mutual responsiveness, so when lovers change, they do not change alone. In embracing love, we embrace the prospect of being changed by and through the love relationship. Shakespeare's claim that love endures through change can come true after all on this account, since the properties or qualities for which we love someone and which justify our love are properties that co-evolve through the course of a relationship. My identity is partly shaped by my beloved's interpretations of me, and in the context of our relationship, I have reason to do things I didn't have reason to do before. So my taste for opera develops under your influence. I become more confident in cracking jokes. You become less focused on saving the world, and we discover a new passion for rock climbing. If over time you become in part my creation and I become in part yours, then in ending this relationship to take on another, I lose something of myself as well as losing you, and that counters any reason we might otherwise have for trading up. This gets closer to the mark, I think, but still you might want to resist reason's talk in the context of love. For love is surely not confined to rational, consenting adults. All this talk about reasons and qualities Mrs. Love's most striking feature. Love is, after all, an emotion. Love picks us up and sweeps us away. It moves us against reason. Where then is any recognition in philosophy of the essential phenomenology of love? Well, a full account of the phenomenology of love is certainly best left to poetry and literature rather than to philosophy. But there are philosophers who hold that love has causes, but not reasons. A colleague of mine, Nick Zangwill, from Durham, argues that love is not at all a matter of judgment or evaluation. It's a primitive, raw, and untamed response which bypasses our cognitive and rational selves, as evidenced by the fact that children, the mad and the demented, may love as fully and passionately as anyone else. Zangwill puts it well. Views of love are often criticised for being over-romantic, but I reply that most moral philosophers could stand to be more rather than less romantic about this subject, which is, after all, love. We should embrace an unapologetically romantic conception of love. If we cannot have a romantic conception of love, what can we have a romantic conception of? Now, part of me wants to stand and cheer at this point. Moral philosophers do have an unfortunate tendency to want to tidy up and sanitise love. They claim it for morality by cheerily dismissing any passions that might lead us astray as not being genuine instances of love. And this colonised version of love seems distinctly unromantic, boring, and unfaithful to the phenomenon. Nonetheless, there's a problem with the kind of view expressed by Zangwill, and not or not simply because it claims that love is fundamentally amoral, or because it allows that love may lead us into moral danger. If love not only has no reasons, but is not concerned with the valuable at all, if it's just untamed raw emotion, then there's no distinction to be drawn between genuine love and various forms of infatuation and obsession. And it's not at all clear that this is what we want from those who claim to love us, any more than we want to be loved for instantiating the other's shopping list of desirable characteristics. We don't, those of us who are grown up at any rate, want to be loved blindly, without any regard for who we actually are.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and this is Jeanette Kennett from the Australian National University.
One of the pleasures of being loved lies in being seen as we really are, in being psychologically visible to the lover. True love, I contend, involves attentiveness to the beloved. It involves really seeing them. Perceptualist accounts of love thus seem to me capable of capturing both the phenomenology of love and the intuition that it's a response to the value of a particular other. So I want to look at a recent account which I think gets tantalisingly close to the truth about love, and then pinpoint where I think it goes wrong. The philosopher David Velleman says this: "In my view, appreciation for someone's value as a person is not incidental to loving him, it's the evaluative core of love. I do not mean that love is a value judgment to the effect that the beloved has value. Love is rather an appreciative response to the perception of that value. And I mean perception literally. The people we love are the ones whom we succeed in perceiving as persons within some of the human organisms milling about us." Love for Velleman is a response to a value that's universal in persons, but that we do not and probably cannot universally and vividly perceive. It's revealed to us via the contingent and particular features of the beloved that capture our attention, the crooked smile, the turn of the head. But what is revealed is the inner presence, the self. Velleman argues further that love is not to be identified with feelings of sympathy, empathy, liking, benevolence or attraction, or with desires to be near or to benefit the beloved. It's clear, he thinks, that we can love relatives or ex-spouses whom we do not much like or wish to be near, or to those whom we stand in more formal relations, whom we wouldn't presume to try to benefit. What unites all the instances of love of a person in Velleman's account is the powerful perception of the other as a person like ourselves. This perception arrests our emotional defences against him, leaving us emotionally vulnerable to him. The heart, Velleman says, responds to another, seen as having a heart. That is why love deserves to be called a moral emotion. It is, in fact, the core moral emotion, the emotion, according to Velleman, by which moral sensibilities are first implanted in children. I want to hold on to Velleman's central idea of love that love involves the vivid and disarming perception of the others as a self, like us. However, I think that there are two points where he goes a little awry. First, Velleman claims love as a moral emotion because it's revelatory of the special value of persons as selves. And since this is a value we all possess, he argues there could be no conflict in spirit between love and morality. Does this mean that love could not lead us into moral danger? Velleman seems to think that it could not. I think he's right to warn us, as he does, against identifying love with some limited range of emotions, feelings and desires that are commonly associated with it, or with particular types of relationships, including romantic ones, which may be ideally but are not necessarily attended by love. Codependency or obsession or possessiveness should be distinguished from love. And so even if, for example, romantic or familial ties can lead us morally astray by providing us with reasons and motives to action which conflict with morality, this doesn't show that it's love that leads us astray. It's harder, however, to draw a moral line between love and the emotions and motives that it unleashes by arresting our emotional defences to the other. On Velleman's account, it's an essential part of love that it arrests those defences. Our emotional responses, he says, are indicative of our having really seen the other. If so, he rather misleadingly characterises the emotions that follow as independent responses that love merely unleashes. Love cannot wash its hands entirely of what it motivates the lover to do. Love can give rise to hate and anger and resentment, and surely we sometimes act wrongly out of that very hate, anger or resentment. And even the favourable emotions that love gives rise to, including empathy, fascination and attraction, may motivate us in ways which conflict with moral requirements. Does this mean there's a conflict in spirit between love and morality? I agree with Velleman that there's not, but neither is there a merely practical conflict. If love is indeed the emotion by which human moral sensibilities are implanted and maintained, then it would seem that our very susceptibility to moral demands is yoked to our moral frailty. They are two sides of the same coin, and that's the paradox at the heart of human moral psychology. Second, and more centrally, while I think that Velleman provides a powerful and accurate account of the phenomenology of love, his conception of the value to which we respond in others is surely too narrow, if not downright false. What he thinks we see and respond to in love is a self-aware, autonomous other, a self-governing, fully-fledged adult, really. But what then of our love for our infant children, which in my experience is fierce, disarming, and utterly revelatory of the value of all children? The phenomenology of love here is just what Velleman describes, but is it based on a wing and a prayer, focused on what will be rather than what is? Is our love for our children based on either an illusion of their personhood or a misunderstanding of the true value of persons? And what of their love for us, or the love expressed by the elderly demented? I side with Zangwill at this point. The capacities and responses which Velleman thinks are critical to love, attention to the other, appreciation of their value as another self, and the resulting emotional disarmament don't arrive fully formed in adults. We find them present, albeit in simpler forms, in infants. Infants attend actively to their parents, initiating and coordinating interactions between them, growing awareness and attentiveness to the other as like me, allied with delight in their presence, sensitivity to their emotions and preferences, which we see even in very young children, deserves to be called love. It thus seems to me that the two compelling components of Velleman's account, the arresting perception of a value distinctive of persons, and the resulting emotional disarmament and vulnerability, can be substantially satisfied in our relations with those whose rational autonomy is undeveloped or diminished. And so to some personal moments of arresting awareness. It's a summer night. My son is two. I wake up to footsteps running through the house and then the slam of the back door. I leap out of bed and follow. In the backyard, he's dancing and whirling under the stars, arms reaching up to them. He looks at me, ecstatic. I can see stars. I can see the moon, he cries. Fast forward. My son is nine. We've just received news that his uncle in England has died. We haven't seen Derek for 6 years. My husband, whose brother it is, doesn't know how to feel. They were not close. The rest of us are awkwardly silent. I pick my son up from his friend's place and deliver the news. When we arrive home, he flings himself into his father's arm and weeps. He gives his father permission to grieve. Fast forward. My son is in his late teens and in a very dark and uncommunicative phase. I phone to tell him that the mother of his oldest friend has cancer. He's silent, and then he says simply, "Tell her. She's been another mother to me. Tell her." And in those few words, I can see him again. What is it precisely that I saw on these three occasions to which love is a proper response? On Velleman's account, I was forcibly alerted to the presence of an inner life alongside my own, an arresting awareness of personhood. True enough, but was it at bottom a vivid awareness of my son's rational autonomy, contingently made available to me on these occasions not via a crooked smile or a tilt of the head, but via his perfectly tuned emotional responses? I don't believe the qualities I saw and responded to on these occasions were signs and symbols of his rational will. What I saw so vividly in the most general sense was my son as a valuer. Emotional and aesthetic responsiveness is not, I submit, merely emblematic of a person's value in the way that a crooked smile might be. It's a true aspect of their value, such that they would be diminished without it. The rational capacities that we dearly wish for our children out of love, and that we may view with wonder and awe as we trace their development, is not the full story of their value as persons here and now or in the future. I don't think we make a mistake or fall under an illusion when we love our children or anyone else in the full recognition that these capacities are not present. I'll finish then with some extracts from Anne Deveson's moving account in Tell Me I'm Here of life with her son Jonathan, who suffered from severe schizophrenia and died aged 24 from a drug overdose. Jonathan's mental and physical decline and Deveson's response starkly reveal the poverty of the quality's view of love and the limits of any appeal to autonomy as a basis for love. Love for Jonathan exposes Deveson to the full gamut of emotions, many of them violent and negative. She describes terrible rage, resentment, frustration, grief and pity. Deveson tells of the last time she saw her son in poor health, covered in sores. He had a large bundle of white pills wrapped in polythene and he went to take two of them. "Please, Jonathan," I begged, "put them away." "Listen," he said, "they gave my father morphine for the pain in his cancer and it helped him, right? And no one's going to tell me not to take stuff for my pain, right?" Later, she found him banging his head and crying. I took him to the couch and held him in my arms and stroked his head and kissed his head, and all the while his body was heaving with sobs while he shuddered at disconnected statements like, "I can't go on, the pain in my head, terrible, terrible, look at me, look at what I've fucking become, oh God." Jonathan's capacity for rational self-government was terribly impaired. His life was one of pain, not of flourishing. Not the life anyone would wish for their child. If autonomy was the sole source of our value of persons, if it were at the heart of our very capacity to value, then it's clear Jonathan did not possess the value to which love is an appreciative response. Yet he, Jonathan, was surely valuable, and his mother made no mistake in loving him. Jonathan was clearly a valuer, and self to himself, like us. Jonathan talked for a long time, and I listened. Then there was silence, even though the music was frolicking and the crowds chattering. Jonathan's phrasing may have been eccentric, but if you spent time with him and felt your way into what he was saying, it was almost always possible to understand him. I looked up. Jonathan was grinning with his head on one side. He looked quite old and wise. "It was a good try, wasn't it? Thank you for listening. That was very brave of you. People have to learn that underlying business, the message of everything is love, which is why society sticks together. You and I have love."
Jeanette Kennett from the Centre for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics at the Australian National University, talking at this year's Melbourne Writers Festival as part of the History of Philosophy in Australia and New Zealand project being undertaken by Monash University. The Philosopher's Zone is produced by Kyla Slavin with technical production by Charlie McCune, and I'm Alan Saunders. The philosophical call for the justification of love at the beginning of the show came, of course, from Madonna, which gives me an opportunity belatedly to wish Madge a happy 50th.
In the Indian state of Orissa, the worst interreligious violence in many years. In France, Scientology goes on trial. In Britain, Channel 4 goes undercover into London's Regent's Park Mosque and finds hatred being preached in the back rooms. And in Austria, a Cistercian monastery tops the pop charts with a glorious recording of Gregorian chant. Around the world on The Religion Report, download or stream this program from the Radio National website.